Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. 2 years ago, after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, we asked our experts, what's next? Are our other constitutional rights in jeopardy? Needless to say, we had plenty to talk about it that year, and again last year. And recent decisions at the close of this year's Supreme Court term, we saw activism, we saw politics, a few surprises, and once again we find ourselves asking, what just happened and what's next? As well, one case made us breathe a sigh of relief, another case would have had us holding our breath, waiting for more of our rights to be struck down, perhaps. Even in the final week of the Supreme Court term, the court launched a shot over the bow of the administrative state, changing course after 40 years and shifted power from the executive branch to the courts. It made it up to the executive branch by granting immunity to the president that were once thought unthinkable. It clarified the right of a city to clear out homeless encampments, and all of this was in the last week? Look, a bit earlier in June, the Supreme Court unanimously dismissed a case that would have limited access to mifepristone, one of the two drugs used in a medical abortion, and have ramifications for other medications as the case sought to reverse the original FDA approval. Tonight we have a lot to cover, and as once again, this list is lengthy. And in many instances, the list appears, again, to be somewhat purposeful. We will hear from three attorneys extraordinaire, and we'll look at the decisions that highlight the Supreme Court's latest term, and perhaps take a look forward as we attempt to see what's next. Now, passions are running high on several of these cases, and we want to hear your take on this. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, give us a call 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And bear in mind that our guests are here to educate and inform you about the legal issues of the day. They can't provide you precise legal advice on your particular case. And the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily the opinions of KALW, NPR, the Bar Association of San Francisco, or any of our guests, employers, or clients. And tonight we have a panel of outstanding guests to help make some sense out of what sometimes appears as constitutional chaos. Having tried cases ranging from antitrust to wire fraud and from patent litigation to white-collar crime and murder, James Brosnahan defended John Philip Walker Lind, the so-called Marin Taliban, an American captured by the United States forces as an enemy combatant during the invasion of Afghanistan, and prosecuted Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger for the Iran-Contra affair. Jim Brosnahan is a local legend. Mr. Brosnahan is the author of Justice at Trial, still a must-read. It hit the bookstands at almost this precise time last year. Ben Foyer is the chairman of the Complex Appellate Litigation Group, a boutique law firm specializing in high-stakes appeals with offices throughout California. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California, and his writing on appellate and constitutional law issues has been published in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle, amongst others. Ann Voigt is a partner at King & Spalding. She previously served as a clerk for the Ninth Circuit and the United States Supreme Court, and formerly worked as a federal prosecutor. Ann has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. And with that, Ben And Jim, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. We are glad to be here.
You know, before we go on to any of these cases in depth, can you tell us a little bit about what these cases tell us about the determination of some of these justices and how far this court may be willing to go in revisiting moderate decisions of the past generation and beyond? And what does this tell us about the future of such cases and what might come out of the 2024 election or resulting from further attack on administrative agencies?
Well, I'll start, because why not? Look, we've got a conservative Supreme Court. For anybody who hasn't been paying attention, this is not just a nominally conservative court, but a clear majority conservative Supreme Court, six conservative appointees, and they are conservative quite clearly, to different degrees. It's not a clear conservative bloc. They disagree with one another. They sometimes align with the liberals. Some of them align with the liberals. Sometimes the liberals align with some of the conservatives. But overall, you've got 6-3, conservative appointees, and you're going to get conservative outcomes in, the cases that are probably the most contentious and the ones that people in some ways care the most about. There were a lot of unanimous opinions this term. Up until the last couple of weeks of the term, this term had the most unanimous decisions of any Supreme Court term since the 1980s. But those were not the cases that people really cared the most about or that really made the most headlines or were the most controversial. And on those cases, the conservative Supreme Court is going to come out in all likelihood with many of them with outcomes that range from kind of conservative to sort of maybe pushing off some of the tough questions for the future. But they are rarely going to come out with sort of clearly left-leaning answers.
You know, what I found interesting is how some of the justices seem to be very entrenched in more political conservatism. And some of the justices, and I'm not talking about the liberal end of the bench either, some of the justices seem to be locked into more judicial conservatism as opposed to activism. And where it gets interesting is where those two part company.
Yeah. And I certainly, welcome my esteemed discussion colleagues here tonight to jump in. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you have some justices, or at least one justice who is clearly an outcome-focused sort of almost MAGA justice in Sam Alito. You have another justice who is exceptionally conservative, incredibly conservative, but not really MAGA. That is, has always had a very conservative outlook. And in fact, one study put this justice is more conservative than 98% of the American population, and that's Clarence Thomas. And those two justices are very interesting because they are both the most conservative justices on the court, but Alito really seems to take his cues from Newsmax more than – I used to say Fox News, but these days it's kind of maybe more Newsmax. Newsmax more than kind of an organized judicial philosophy, whereas Thomas has an organized judicial philosophy that's just – unbelievably conservative in terms of how it works. And then you have the Trump justices, who you would think might be the most MAGA justices, but they aren't. They're in some ways some of the more, I don't want to say swing justices because they're definitely not swing justices, but they're certainly not the most conservative justices on the court, or at least most regularly conservative justices on the court. And maybe even not the most MAGA justices on the court. In some ways, I think that's indicative of Donald Trump's first term, where he really stepped away from the judicial appointment process, left it to Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society to essentially tell him who the good judges were, who he should nominate. And as long as they looked the part, as long as they looked like they were out of judicial central casting, which is what Trump cared about, he was happy to nominate them. I suspect if there is a second Trump term, we would get a much more involve Donald Trump in choosing justices and judges based on their judicial philosophies rather than leaving it up to the Federalist Society, largely because the justices that and judges that Trump appointed haven't always ruled in his favor. And as far as Trump is concerned, that's the only thing that matters when it comes
criteria.
To judging.
Yeah.
It's the only criteria. Do you owe me something? He's a transactional thinker, always has been. What I appointed you, you owe me. And that's it, right? And I think that in a second term, Trump Unleashed, I think you would see the nomination and appointment of some very MAGA Trumpian judges as opposed to kind of these judicial conservatives. You also get the same division on the liberal side. I mean, Sonia Sotomayor does not really have an organized judicial philosophy. She really is, you know, very much focused on the outcome, I think. Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson's very new, but they seem to have a little bit more of an organized philosophy that doesn't always go always to the left outcome.
Ben, you opened the door when you asked about loyalty to the president and how that might lead or loyal to the former president. I guess we have a couple that might be loyal to the president, to the current. But I want to shift it over to Anne to ask about how you think it would be with cases coming, if any, coming out of the 2024 election. I know you've lived through this before. It's been a little while. How do you see this coming down? The election is contested along the lines that it was back in 2000. How do you see this lining up?
Oh, so I think that'll be a real test for the Chief Justice, who's traditionally thought of as an institutionalist. He really cares about how the Supreme Court is perceived. I think there's a general recognition that Bush v. Gore damaged the Supreme Court's, you know, perception, the public perception of the Supreme Court. So I think if there's a way for them to duck it, they probably would. But ultimately, I think if they're forced to deal with it, I don't think we're going to see any giant surprises in how people rule.
I mean, to be clear, you know, I think that most of the conservative justices, again, leaving aside Alito and probably Thomas, have no love for Donald Trump. I think we've seen that in their opinions. Roberts clearly hates the man. Some of the other conservatives, I mean, they see him as an impediment to the conservative project, right, in many ways. Now, Trump 2.0 might not be, right? There's got this terrifying America 2025, Project 2025 plan, right? His campaign is clearly much more organized and disciplined than it was last time. He may be crazier than he's ever been, but there are many justices that would be perfectly happy to see the conservative movement move on from Donald Trump. Instead of kind of thinking about what might happen with a contested election, God forbid, can we just get through the convention, figure out who the nominee is going to be, right, for the Democrats, get through the conventions, and then start worrying about how terrifying it might be if you have a very close election, with Trump already sort of calling for violence in the streets if he loses, right?
I'm sorry, Jim, you look like you had something to add to that.
Say that I agree. It's an activist conservative court. It feels its power, and it's putting in place. It has done some, and it will do a lot more. Theories that have been in the Federalist Society for a long time. One of them, a major one, which we're going to get to, is a very powerful president. A very powerful president. Even to it showed up in a movie called VP. That whatever the president does. Is right, no matter what it is, and we're going to get to that. But they are set in place based on what they're doing so far to limit abortion further, to limit allow some, but limit guns regulation. They did that this year. They allowed one little snippet, if you don't mind, of a gun regulation while denying another one with regard to machine guns. So this is a very conservative court, but I will say in their defense as a lawyer, that if you look at all the cases, you get a different picture of them as people. And I've been doing that every year for years. And I think you'll find Gorsuch moving over to the progressives occasionally. I think Barrett is a fascinating possibility. And I think she's finding herself to some extent, but she's not afraid to speak out. There's a lot more to it, but I'll stop there.
Dean Johnson had an interesting theory. He used to say on this air fairly regularly, he would enunciate his least conservative justice theory. And that's really the pivot point. And he goes back to recent history with some fairly conservative justices, fairly conservative courts. And he would always find the fifth, who's going to be the swing vote. You know, we've talked a bit about broader pictures. I'd like to focus on some of these cases. And as we discussed earlier, it appears the court decided 59 cases in this past year, many of which were back in June. I'd like to talk about some of the ones that people are listening to. And if they haven't heard about it, the facts of these cases are going to get people fired up. For example, let's talk about the cities and homelessness and what the court just decided. And we can talk a little more about what it's going to mean in San Francisco. Is there anybody that likes that decision or wants to speak in favor of it?
Oh, I do, and I'm happy to speak in favor of it. You know, I think this decision was, in fact, clearly – this is a decision that you probably heard of called, you know, that goes by the name of Grants Pass, because there's a town in Oregon called Grants Pass that banned the issue really was whether or not the homeless can have tents, can set up tents on in public parks and essentially – you know, take over public parks with tents, right? And I have a longstanding theory that much of the homeless crisis that we're experiencing in the United States and around the world arises more than anything else from the tents. Tents got less expensive as they were manufactured inexpensively in China, and there are organizations that go around giving out these tents to people. And you know what? If you've got a tent and you're living on the street, that is a lot better than living just on the street. And that makes people, I think, a lot more willing to do that, especially if there are sort of drugs and mental illness involved. But so this really arose out of a decision around 10 years ago from the Ninth Circuit called Martin against Boise, Idaho, where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that laws that make essentially loitering on public property a crime, that is, you know, essentially just sleeping on the street or whatever, a crime, that those laws violate the Eighth Amendment unless the city can offer, and the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, unless the city or municipality can offer a place, a bed, for the homeless people to sleep in. So essentially saying that banning homelessness or making it a crime to be homeless on the streets violates the federal constitution unless the city can offer a bed for these folks. And look, I absolutely think cities should create not only inexpensive housing, but shelters sufficient for every homeless person who wants one. Many don't, but who wants one to have a bed where they are safe and they are warm and hopefully get treatment and help getting on their feet. But the idea that this is part of the federal constitution, that 200 years of laws banning vagrancy and loitering are unconstitutional unless the cities can provide a bed, that clearly doesn't fall within the Constitution historically, the way it's been understood historically, the way it's been understood in the United States. It's a nice idea. Maybe, and in fact, I like I said, I think cities should do this. They should provide this, feature out of the caring that we as citizens have for fellow people, fellow human beings. But the idea that cities can't ban this if they want to, if the citizens want to do that, that to me was clearly wrong from the start. And the Supreme Court finally sort of got to it, realized the crisis this was helping to create. And through that, law out. So I'm willing to speak in favor of Grant's path. I think it was the right decision.
Well, the devil's in the application, the details. I mean, the reality is that if you make it, if the city's not bound to do anything but to say, well, we don't like you in the parks, we don't like you on the streets, we don't like you really anywhere, obviously we've got a problem that way too. Jim, how do you feel about this?
Well, I think the issue is under the Eighth Amendment, whether it's cruel or unusual. And I think that Ben has an important legal point that he can claim, as he should, that it's unusual in the sense that it goes all the way back of rousting people, taking their property and driving out, even in San Francisco over the years in the Western Addition. There were a whole lot of people driven out of San Francisco. So there's a long history that makes it usual. Then the question is it cruel? I think most religions, for example, if those in the country right now are drawing upon religious teachings for law in certain sections on certain issues, is it cruel? I would say, yes, it is. But the problem with my argument, to make it more interesting, is when I say it's cruel, that means that evokes the idea of a right to housing, which has been mumbled about by Democrats for years. I think Hubert Humphrey gave a stem-winding speech at one point where he suggested there were all these basic rights, and a right to housing was one of them. I close with this, the scene. Someone is in a tent. It's cold. They have no place to go. They couldn't pay the rent. They were thrown out of their other house by the courts. The courts very often are required by law to enforce leases that create people. And my bias is, frankly, that if we someday have a court that has an expanded view of what is cruel, I will personally be very happy. But that's my bias.
And you and I spoke about this before going on the air. Doesn't this decision lead to more cities, more states willing to simply give people the alternative of going to jail or getting on the bus?
They've already done that. They've done that, and they're doing it in San Francisco. They must do it now under the law, or at least they believe they must do it. They could have a more humane system if they wanted to, but they're enforcing this. And people are on the move. Think about heat in San Francisco. Think about cold in San Francisco. Think about, if I may add, hunger.
Think about drug addiction in San Francisco. Think about feces on the street.
Let me just finish.
Okay.
You begin to understand one of the issues in this court, and that is occasionally, let me put it politely, a lack of sensitivity about the effect that their cases have on real people.
I mean, I think Jim, to be frank, has an imaginative version of sort of who the homeless are.
I didn't make it up.
Maybe a little bit made up. I mean, the reality of the homeless.
Nice ideas.
I mean, maybe in Berkeley, you know.
I don't mean any disrespect, but we could get hung up on a definition of the homeless. And the fact is, if you start thinking of, quote unquote, the homeless as one cohesive body of folks, we've already lost reality. Let me turn it to a caller on the line. Is it Enoch from Antioch? Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I just had a quick question and comment, and then I can take my answer off the air so I can free up a phone line. So, to my understanding, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was not a proponent of Roe v. Wade, even though she was a proponent of a woman's right to have an abortion, because she did not like the legislation as it was written. That's what I understand to be true. And my question is, would not an amendment to the Constitution solve all of this problem? Because nothing unites the left like their bloodlust for infanticide, I think you can get it done. I will take my comments off the air.
So just to respond, you know, I think Justice Ginsburg had notably said that she thought that Roe v. Wade, not that it was wrong, but that it was grounded in the wrong principle, that instead of being based on a right to privacy, that it should really be based on gender equality. So, but with that caveat, I don't think she certainly was supportive of abortion rights.
Yeah, I mean, she later said, I mean, she did say, you know, sort of towards the end of her career that, you know, she thought one of the problems with Roe v. Wade is that it crystallized the abortion debate as of 1970, you know, whatever. And the, you know, and we've certainly seen since the end of Roe v. Wade a, you know, some shifting and, you know, on the abortion issue, but it certainly hasn't been as clear cut, I think, as some of the conservatives hoped. And in fact, it's been an issue that's really animated, people, even some, you know, women who are might otherwise be conservative voters or Republican voters in states that are very, very, red states, red is Republican, right? Yeah. To vote in favor of sort of state constitutional amendments protecting abortion, or even to vote for liberal Supreme Court justices in those states. So freeing abortion and returning it to the states has led to some states where it's really quite terrible, and you see maternal death rates going up, and you know some very destructive aspects, but also other states where they have Republican control, but are coming out with these sort of state ballot measures and state elections that are hinging on the right to abortion. So, she certainly had a point, I guess.
You know, just one thought, Jeff, on what we are talking about, that issue, and I agree with what Ben just said, but there is a strain in this court that is deeply troubling, and that is so many of their reactions are, and I'm not trying to be pejorative, I'm trying to be analytical, they are authoritarian. And all I mean by that is the simple idea that we will tell you what you're going to have to do, and I won't take your time to list all the things that are happening in certain states, but the authoritarian instincts in the conservative thinking process at the moment is as strong as I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's such a thing as a, you know, sort of liberal conservatism with a small L, you know, let libertarianism, yes, let people do what they want to do. But there's also an illiberal conservatism that is really on the upswing. You see it in other countries, right? In Hungary,
yes,
Russia, and so forth.
In European countries.
And you certainly see it among the Christian nationalist strain of the Republican Party and the right wing, where they want to tell you what to do. There was something I was reading where they want to make people start wearing, men start wearing suits again. You know, that's a thing now, right? So the, you know, that illiberal conservatism, illiberal, not with a big L, but with a small L, is different from, in critical ways, from the kind of conservatism we've seen a lot of in the 20th century and early 21st century.
Yep, I agree.
You know, real quickly,
some fissuring, if you don't mind, Jeff, I was going to say really quickly, I think you see some real fissuring even among conservative judges between judges who I think fall in the little L liberal conservatives and then the others who are not. And it's been interesting watching some of the pushback from the Supreme Court with the Fifth Circuit, which is, you know, very heavily conservative right now, and seeing them actually get, for lack of a better phrase, their hands slapped.
You know, there is a case that did involve abortion that came up in the last couple of weeks, which was had to do with the ability to get the anti-abortion drugs. I discussed it in the opening. That right has been preserved, which is kind of a carve-out from the staunch anti-abortion or any kind of birth control decision direction that the court's been going. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
I'd like to shift gears. There's another case which has gotten enormous attention, particularly in the last week or so, which has to do with the president, the former president, whether he can be prosecuted, what cases are going forward. What I'd like to do is to break this discussion down a little bit. To make it understandable, I'm going to turn first to you, Anne, and ask you if you can very briefly sum it up so people know what we're talking about. And since the devil's in the details, I'm going to have us flesh it out. Jim will speak in opposition, what's wrong with this decision. Ben will speak in favor of it. And by the time we're done, we'll have a pretty good idea of what has just happened with presidential immunity, unlike any picture I could draw or perhaps put in the chat. Anne, would you like to talk a little bit about Trump versus United States?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I just think it'll come as no surprise when the decision came down that it was a deeply divided one. But the top line result was that the majority held that former presidents basically can never be prosecuted for any actions that relate to what they called the core powers of their office, and that there's at least a presumption that they have immunity for their official acts more broadly. So while it leaves open the possibility that you could have the charges that the special counsel has brought against former President Trump, that they could still go forward to the extent that they're based on his private conduct rather than his official acts. I think it's, in reading the opinion, it is hard to figure out how, as a practical matter, even while they left this sort of hypothetical possibility open, as a practical matter, how that's actually going to work. But Jim and Ben, I'm curious what your take is, if there's actually daylight there where there could actually be a prosecution, or if it's just, as a practical matter, impossible.
I did listen to the argument on the immunity, and I found it very, very interesting and somewhat contrary to what they actually did. I'd like to start with what they actually did. They took a pending criminal case, pending in the trial court, that had never been tried. There was no trial record of the witnesses, the details, or anything like that. There is no trial record from which they might make legal opinions. They made a totally new rule. The new rule was a presumption. The presumption was that the president, whoever the president might be, is engaged in official acts. And that would have to be somehow overcome. There's a very important old case called Tott, T-O-T. And that old case eviscerates the idea of using presumptions because they are a substitute for facts. Having done that, they then applied their new rule to the facts of the former president's pending criminal case. And they, in my view, and I think this is correct, they then applied the presumption, and having applied the presumption, they ruled out two of the more serious pending crimes. It is true, and I agree with Anne, that other things are still pending. I agree with Ben, we don't really know yet, I think, what's going to happen in this particular case. And so we'll all wait and we'll watch it. I have classified, forgive the rhetoric, because that's what it is. This is one of four of the worst cases in the history of the court, and their legacy will carry it with them for a long time. I just wish that we had people in the government that would articulate that in that way, because I was more troubled when this happened, having been a lawyer for many years, than any case, even some of my own. So that's my feeling about it, and I think I'm right.
Ben, those words are pretty compelling, and I appreciate your willingness to step in and try to defend what sounds like it's not defensible. You know, crime is such an ugly word. I prefer official acts. And if that's really how we're going to define it, is there really a defense to that decision?
Yeah, you know, I agree with Jim in the sense that in my career at this point, you know, several decades of lawyering and paying very close attention to constitutional law, this is one of the very few cases where I really don't know what the ultimate real impact of this will be. And there are several reasons for that, okay? One reason is that, the first question, I think, which is a fair question to ask, does the president act or not act based on his or her concern that they will be prosecuted criminally at some point? We have never had a criminal prosecution of a president until Donald Trump. So I think the first question to ask is the president really one way or the other is his decision making really affected by this threat of potential criminal prosecution, whatever that might be? Another, question, I think a very important question that we will come to see is, will the courts, and I think they will, but will the courts differentiate the act of getting elected, and the process of politicianing, for lack of a better word, from the official acts of the president? Right. You have his hush money case in New York. You have the prosecution over, what he encouraged people to do on January 6th. You have his decision to keep, secret records in the bathroom at Mar-a-Lago after he left office. His trophy collection. Maybe to use for bribery or leverage or to sell. Are these official acts of a president in any way? And would any of those actually be affected? Any of those prosecutions be affected by this? Certainly the January 6th prosecution comes closest. I have a very hard time seeing how his hush money payments could, to his porn star mistress could be considered an official act of the president. Keeping records after you leave office, doing anything after you leave office can't be an official act of the president. So, how will this percolate out as the courts actually start looking at the behavior that in which Donald Trump engaged? Now, the scarier, risk is, the facts that the idea or the theory, the concern that the dissent raised, which is that the president will order the assassination of a political opponent. Is that an official act of the president? Hard to see how that would be. Maybe the president thinks that his political opponent is somebody who is committing treason or is a danger to democracy. Does that make it an official act to order the assassination of a political opponent? I have a hard time seeing it. That said, how do you prove it? Because the Supreme Court went on to say in its opinion that the president's communications with his executive, the people who work for him, the attorney general and so forth, those are generally going to be privileged. Those can't form a basis for prosecution.
Which is really scary when you apply it to the Trump administration as opposed to other administrations we've had, because most of them, they're picked to do the job, at least as it relates to the president's vision of what that job is, whereas the Trump administration had chosen from members of the family or someone who he feels is loyal to him and has nothing to do with the job they're chosen to do.
Absolutely. I think that was probably the most clear, to me, the most clearly problematic part of the decision. And Justice Barrett dissented on that ground. She concurred with the result that there should be immunity for official acts, but really dissented on that evidentiary issue. Now, the idea that the president should be immune for official acts, that does make a lot of sense, I have to say.
I have to agree with you there.
Acts. Absolutely, right?
The reality is, we have to analyze the idea of it outside of the person that it's going to at least initially apply to. And the reality
Absolutely.
Is this decision is going to be with us for a long, long time. And there will be presidents, whether or not President Trump is reelected or whether President Biden's reelected, we're going to have future presidents, and they're going to be looking at this same guidance. So the principle's correct, but when you look at the details, aren't there troublesome details, the way that they drew the lines?
Is it too broad? Yeah, and this is, maybe. I mean, this is why I say it's going to take time to figure out whether this was a terrible decision that's going to lead to, you know, the president assassinating his political opponents, as Justice Sotomayor said, or setting up military tribunals for his political opponents, as Trump has suggested he would want to do for Liz Cheney. But could the president really do that? I mean, Trump says a lot of things, right? And most of them are complete nonsense. Even if the president is immune from criminal prosecution, again, this is, I'm not convinced that this is really something that constrains the president's behavior generally, except when you have, you know, someone like Trump running saying, I'm going to prosecute you, Joe Biden. Can the president set up a military tribunal for his political opponents, even if he's immune from criminal prosecution? I'm not sure how he can, and I'm not sure why immunity really would affect it. That is, if he could, I don't know that his criminal immunity is going to have anything to do with whether or not he does that, right? Maybe it does, but I'm somewhat skeptical. On the other hand, you know, Richard Nixon got a pardon. It was ordering, you know, the plumbers to break into the Democratic National Committee and plant bugs. Was that part of Richard Nixon's official duties? Again, I don't think that a court would find that they were. But how would you prove it? Because Nixon had to tell his subordinates to do that, right? He had the tapes. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of open questions. There's a lot of rhetoric about how this is one of the worst decisions in American history. And it may well turn out to be that way. But I'm not sure. And I think that we're just going to have to see how it pans out before we'll know.
Let's. I want to give a quick chance to Jim to respond and a quick for Anne to respond.
Sure.
But then I want to move on.
Very short, Jeff. How long has it been that no one was above the law? And how did that happen? Lord Coke looked at the king, James I, who was trying to interfere with the courts. And he was trying to take over the development of law on a certain subject. And Lord Coke, kneeling in front of him, looked up and he said, no one is above the law. I heard someone on TV, I think yesterday morning, make that reference. That is part of what the people in America believe. And if you want to suggest, you'll be right, by the way, that I'm just engaged in rhetoric. It's very old rhetoric. It's 500 years of assumptions that went away with this decision. Sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
But look, legislators can't be prosecuted for what they do on their way to, you know, when Congress is in session. Judges can't be prosecuted for their official acts. They haven't been able to for a long time. So a lot of people are sort of above the law when they're, you know, engaged in their official duties.
Police officers get that defense very often.
They get right. Police officers have a certain kind of qualified immunity, right? If they're doing something that isn't clearly illegal in advance. So there are a lot of people who are sort of above the law in reality. I think the question is, how will this play out in practice, right?
I agree with your thought about waiting to see what happens. I agree with you. Yeah.
And if there's a meeting of the minds between these two, can you take us there?
I'm not sure that there is, although I think we all are in agreement that we'll see how this actually plays out. And, you know, this is a case where, you know, it seems to sort of emblematic of the idea that bad facts can make for bad law. You know, this is a pretty unique set of circumstances. And so one can be both worried about the potential for political abuse of prosecutions of former presidents and still feel in this case that perhaps the prosecution is appropriate.
Yeah, imagine a situation.
So we'll see which of the two presidents is closer to SEAL Team 6. Let me move on.
Just before you move on, just imagine a situation where Joe Biden, you know, issues an executive order that his agencies should engage in DEI, right, should consider diversity in hiring. And if future President Trump or one of these other people tries to prosecute Biden for doing that on the basis that that violated the civil rights of white people, you could almost see that happening, right? And this, you know, this might, that might be a different fact pattern that might lead listeners to say, hey, you know, maybe there should be some kind of immunity for the president in situations like that.
Now, we'll leave that to Congress to go after people for policy issues, but let's move on. We've got some other cases which may mean more to lawyers and less to other folks. We can go through them in a bit more rapid fashion. One of the things that I've found interesting of this current Supreme Court, as it's been the last couple of years, is that they're going back and looking at moderate decisions of years past and scrapping them, per se. One of those was a case involving the so-called Chevron Doctrine. Who would like to explain it? I'll tell you what, Ben, can you give us a very quick summary of it? Because I know that Anne is opposed to it and Jim's in favor of it. So, Ben, can you give us a very fast, neutral, 30-second summary of what that means?
Sure. Look, after World War II, we developed something in the United States called the administrative state. A lot of administrative agencies that were a subset of the executive, a subset of the presidency, came about via acts of Congress, and they handled very technical things in terms of regulation. It involved food safety, the environment, the way ships and bridges are built, all kinds of things that are highly, highly technical that the government issues regulations on all the time. And the Supreme Court started wrestling at that point with how judges should look at the regulations that come out. And at first, the Supreme Court said, look, judges should look at those regulations and see if they seem to reasonably comport with the statute. And if the judges agree that they do, then the judges should approve the regulations. And then in the 1980s, as the administrative state really started being at almost its peak of complexity, and incredibly technical science issues and, you know, just very technical stuff that was really scientist, focused. The Supreme Court said, look, we're just judges. We're just normal people. We're not scientists. We don't know that much about the way the environment works or these chemicals work or the food safety works. And so we're going to say that, look, you know, by and large, if, you know, when people challenge government regulations, by and large, courts should defer to the regulatory agency's own interpretation of what the statutes say.
Let the experts decide instead of calling on people who basically call balls and strikes all day.
Yeah, let the experts decide, basically, unless they've really gone way off the reservation, let the experts decide what is gonna, you know, what their own statutes cover and what is sort of a reasonable way to do things and what isn't. Now, I think it's important to recognize that was a tremendous transfer of power. The case that in which the Supreme Court said that it said that was Chevron USA against the National Resources Defense Council. That was a tremendous transfer of power from the courts to the executive branch of the government.
And that's been there for like 40 years now, right?
40 years.
40 years this month.
That's been there for 40 years.
What happened?
And then in a case this term called Loper-Bright, that's going by the name of Loper-Bright, which is really a great name, almost sounds like a science fiction kind of name for a case. The Supreme Court said that was wrong. It's our job to interpret statutes and determine whether some regulation comports with a statute or the administrative agency's claim that it has the power to do one thing or another, whether that comports with the statute, because we're the courts. We're the ones who are supposed to say what the law is. It's not the executive branch. So it's interesting because and they overruled this Chevron case. And what's interesting, because Jim is absolutely right in what he said in the last segment on Trump, the right wing has, the illiberal right wing has an autocratic strain in which they want to give more and more power to the person, the executive, the king, the president. They're okay with a lot of power in the hands of these folks. But this case, in some ways, takes power away from the executive and gives it back to the judiciary.
I want to give everybody a chance to be heard on this because we're running rapidly out of time.
Go.
Let me turn it to Jim. Was this a good idea?
Okay. Here's what happened in the case. This doctrine allowed an agency to establish the law and then have real judges under Title III of the United States Constitution defer to them. That is quite different than looking at it and deciding what the law is. It is or it isn't. No, they deferred to it. I agree with this decision, Loper Bright, because people who are regulators do not decide the law under our constitutional system. And I appreciate that on the liberal side, contrary to what I just said, they want regulations. They want more regulations. This will limit the abilities of regulatory commissions and others. By the way, I digress for one second. No one knows how many federal commissions and agencies there are. They don't know the number, which tells you something. So I'm
okay, but Jim, let me interrupt you and ask you a simple question.
Yeah.
Doesn't this create a scenario where instead of having to listen to an agency who may have been made up of people that spent their whole careers learning more and more about less and less and knowing every detail about how the sausage is made and saying, well, we know how to get around that. If we want to protect oil drilling, we go to the place in the country that is the most beholden to oil drilling. If we want to talk in favor of food additives, we go to the place away from the FDA and make them come to the place where the food additives are made so that we have the most friendly forum we can. Forum shopping will grow astronomically under this. Do you agree?
My reaction to what you're pointing out is that I'm all for scientists. I'm pro-scientists, even though they're wrong sometimes, and they change their opinion, and it's a fluid kind of thing. But it got Western civilization this far. But they don't get to decide the law. They're governed by the law. They don't get to decide the law. And that's the distinction that I'm making that I think supports the Chevron decision.
And you look like you don't agree.
So, I'll say, I'm curious about how much impact this decision will practically have. For all the fuss over Chevron and its impact, the truth is that the government itself had backed away from using it as a defensive agency action. Query whether down the road this is just sort of a lot of hullabaloo over something that actually won't make much of a difference in how cases are decided. There is, I think, some irony, though, that while talking about how courts are better positioned than agencies to make these sort of decisions, the same week Justice Gorsuch had to correct one of his decisions because he got the chemicals involved in a particular case wrong. He referred to laughing gas as opposed to a different chemical. So it may be an assertion of authority that turns out to be sort of a way of ending up with pie on their face.
Yeah, I mean, and keep in mind, you know, Jeff, this works both ways, right? When Trump is in office, hopefully never again, but if Trump is in office, or there will be a time when a Republican or conservative is in office, they're going to be appointing, you know, heads of different agencies.
No way we're going to get to it.
Who may want to, issue regulations, have the agencies issue regulations that have conservative impacts. And the question will also then go to the courts. Hopefully not in a forum shopping way, although that does seem to be part of the process now. And the courts will decide then also whether those attempts are, you know, within what the statute, what Congress intended with the statute. There's also some thinking that this might force Congress to actually start doing things again, right? We have an unbelievably unproductive Congress, which we, and we've had unproductive Congresses now for the last 10 or so years. And, you know, partly because they can get away with being unproductive. The administrative agencies do a lot of the work. So they don't have to. You don't need a Clean Water Act when you, a new Clean Water Act, when the EPA can just kind of change what the law is or expand what the law is to handle situations that arise. So, you know, and the court's been pushing back on that on, in other ways, but maybe this will force Congress to actually do stuff. Another case where we will have to see how it really shakes out.
And the real question is, do we at some level end up losing a lot of expertise because of the implementation of this decision? Or, on the other side, do we have people with greater accountability being the ones that make the decisions now? Because the courts are much easier for us to all see what's happening. And if we can't elect or unelect the judges, at least we can unelect the people who've appointed them. So there's some level of accountability, some level of control, which doesn't exist with the administrative agencies. I think we'll find out in good time. The last case, when we're down to about probably 30 seconds, but the one that I think we'll pick it up with next time, and next time's coming up in a few weeks, is, when's a bribe not a bribe? When's a gratuity not a gratuity?
When you pay the money afterwards.
Yeah.
That's what
that's the answer.
So that, so that your audience will tune in and they want to hear about that. You pay the bribe money afterwards and it's okay. That's
yeah. You just wink ahead of time. You just wink. Right? You don't promise the bribe. You just wink at them. And then
oh, my.
The other one I think maybe we take up later has to do with Big Pharma and the opioid crisis. Apparently, we've been really propping up and protecting the pharmaceutical industry until we didn't. I see a lot of nods. We are basically out of time, so I'm not going to push anybody to answer that. Till next time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Our guests tonight have been appellate attorneys extraordinaire Ben Foyer and Ann Voigt, Jim Brosnahan, a local attorney, a local legend amongst attorneys, this far short of a local legend, I guess, and the author of Justice at Trial. Hit the bookstands about a year ago, and it remains a must-read for those who haven't seen it. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week at 6, where we continue with last week's program about protesting the First Amendment and your job. In 2 weeks, we're back with landlord-tenant law. Then we're back to complete this discussion. We're back on July 31st to finish our view of the United States Supreme Court. As always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks again to tonight's guests for joining us at this most enlightening discussion. And a big thanks to all of you for listening in, and those who have called. And at the controls, we have Joanne Marr. I am Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.